History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll take a little initiative to ask a few questions and, more importantly, take the time to patiently listen to what comes back our way. Our perspective might just change. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I am in rural Fresno, California, out in the middle of a bunch of grapevines, currant vines, and I'm sitting with 97-year-old Doug Johnson. We're going to hear what he was up to in World War II and since. But Doug, let's go way back. You grew up in Southern California during the Great Depression. What do you remember about those growing up years? You had an older sister and a younger sister, right?
My father was an architect, and he worked for Lowe's Pantages Corporation. He was salaried prior to 1924 at $80,000 a year, and that was a lot of money back then.
That's a lot of money in the 20s.
A lot of money back then. He was one of the leading architects for the Lowe's Pantages Corporation, which wound up to be Warner Brothers.
Uh-huh.
He did a lot of theaters. He did part of the theater in Fresno.
The Warner's Theater?
Warner's Theater. He was supervised construction when they were in their final stage. My grandfather was a sculptor, and he was also employed by MGM, and he did the lions at MGM, sculpted the lions that MGM had on their entry. So I was from a family of sculptors. My grandfather was also a musician. My dad, we had a big Nash touring car, as I can recall. And when the Depression hit, my dad, being he was one of the top-notch employees at Lowe's Pantages, was given a job as chauffeur running a LaSalle touring car for the elite coming out of the East Coast to see Hollywood. So he did that along with drafting. He worked for different architectural firms in L.A. too, kind of on the side. And I can remember him sitting at his drafting board in our house. He was a chain smoker cigarette, and he'd have a cigarette in the ashtray, full-length cigarette in the ashtray, smoldering. He'd take one puff on it, put it back down again, continue drafting, get ready to take another puff, and it was all ashes, so he'd light another cigarette. So we lived in a house full of smoke. It didn't seem to bother anybody. My sister was 4 years older than I was, and my younger sister was 6 years younger. My dad continued working there and did the mortuary at Santa Paula. The mortuary was designed as a mission. By that design, my dad was wanted quite a bit and had seven mortuaries to design, and then the war broke out. So he came up here and went to work for PG&E as a draftsman, and he did the architectural work on the homes at Bass Lake that they have for retired PG&E employees. He also eventually went into business for himself, and then was a building contractor. He held a license not as an architect because he was from London. He had his citizenship papers, but at that time he could not get a license. When I got out of the service, I did work with him, and Johnson & Johnson was the architectural firm or building firm. I built a dairy at Madeira. I built the clothing store for Long's up in Chowchilla. Then I built the theater at Biola.
Which is still standing. You can drive right past it.
Still there.
I want to ask you about that childhood, and maybe there's something here, maybe not, but you mentioned when the Depression hit, your dad becoming the chauffeur for the company in that LaSalle touring car. Did he ever have a take his son to work day? Did you ever get to ride along in there?
No, not really, because all the women, usually it was women. And I can remember, I think it was 1933, we lived on Clinton in Los Angeles, and the earthquake hit. We were in a two-story apartment, and my dad got us all down on the ground floor and out into the parking lot, and we were watching the transformers swinging back and forth on the power poles.
Wow.
And so we ran through that earthquake, and then everything was chaotic from then on. My dad and mother went on welfare because everything shut down, you know, during that time. Mm. So the government came in and ran a food program, and you get a shopping bag full of food, you know. So I can remember that. My grandmother was all part of the same group. The days of being raised during the Depression where I had to do everything on my own. If I wanted any money, I sold magazines. I got a few pennies, Lady Holmes Journal, Saturday Evening Post, you name it. I sold one door-to-door selling magazines, a nickel apiece at that time. I went to Hollywood. I graduated from a junior high school and went to Hollywood High School in the 10th grade. And Hollywood High School border was Waring Avenue, which is the entrance to the RKO studio. And they moved the district from Waring out away from us, and I had to go to Fairfax. So I went to Fairfax in the second half of the 10th grade and finished at Fairfax High School.
I'm curious if you remember as a young man, and certainly the Depression and what your family's going through is coloring your perspective, but do you remember having a dream, an ambition of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
No, not really. When I was 13, I was peddling Hollywood Citizen News. I made about $4 a month. And at that time, Gordon Varney, the model railroad man from England, opened a store on Melrose. And being 13 years old and loving to see trains, I had a Lionel of my own, but loving to see trains, I used to go down and watch him run his trains around there. And Gordon Varney finally put up with me, I guess, enough, and he said, would you like to own an engine? And I said, oh, I'd love to have an engine. He says, can you pay for it? And it's $5. I said, no, I can't pay for it. I work for the paper. And he says, what can you pay? I said, about 50 cents a week. He says, if you can pay 50 cents a week, here's the engine and here's some track. So that's how I got started in model railroad in 1936.
Uh-huh.
And I have a layout now that's 9 feet wide and 16 feet long. So it's one of the largest layouts, I'm told, here in California.
So you finish at Fairfax High School. You graduate 1941?
Actually, in January 1942.
So something happened before that. Something happened your senior year that was pretty significant in the world. December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you heard about what happened there?
Well, I was riding my bicycle, I remember, and I went by a building, and people were out running, hollering, there's a war, there's a war. And it didn't mean anything to me. At that age, it didn't ring a bell. And when I got home, my folks were telling me all about what had happened at Pearl Harbor. But at school, even in high school, we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Mm-hmm. You know, we had no idea it was in the Hawaiian Islands. And so the school then was all Pearl Harbor. Everything was all Pearl Harbor. And we learned about Pearl Harbor and the war. We were in the beginning of the Liberty ships and the airplanes that were flying. You know, prior to that, we had two Zeppelins, big Zeppelins, the Grafsby and the Macon. They used to fly over Los Angeles all the time. And they grounded them during the war, although I understand they did use them for observation. You know, those are two of the biggest dirigibles ever built in this country.
You know, and I've talked to some folks who were around Southern California during that time right after Pearl Harbor, and some of them have shared this concern that, hey, the Japanese are going to come to the Southern California coastline. And I've heard stories of, you know, air raid wardens and spotlights at night lighting up the sky or imposed blackouts so you wouldn't be a target for bombers. Did you see life changing in any ways like that where you were?
No, we lived on Waring Avenue. The alley in the back, I had a Model T. Somebody gave me a Model T. And this Japanese fella at that time came by and bought it from me for $15. They came and got it, and at the end of the alley was the Japanese family. But they were well-liked by everybody in town, so nobody ever paid any attention to the Japanese people where I lived. They were all well thought of. They were very ingenious people. They had a big garden behind their house and used to give vegetables and carrots and different things to different neighbors. So nobody had anything against the Japanese that I can remember.
You were probably up here by the time they started rounding them up and sending them to the camps, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I believe so, but I lived on a farm. I worked on the farm with my brother-in-law. They gave me credit in high school for working on the farm.
Oh, really?
So in 1939, I only went to 3 classes in high school.
You came up here and were working in the Fresno area?
All during the summer, and then I'd work on in to harvest up here, and we'd go back down to school. And Dieter was the principal, and he called me into his office, and he said, "You are not going to graduate this year." And I said, "Why am I not going to graduate?" And he said, "You've only been to 3 classes." And I said, "Well, I was excused from the classes." He said, "Not by this office." And I said, "Well, you're not going to let me graduate?" And he said, "No." And I said, "I'll tell you what, I'm in charge of the stage crew. The extravaganza is supposed to be put on." And I said, "I'm in charge of the stage crew and all the workers, and we're not going to put on the extravaganza." And I was only 17 years old at that time. And they finally came over and they said, "We'll let you graduate." So I did graduate, but I only got 3 classes on my report card.
I never heard a story quite like that. And what kind of work were you doing up here on the farm?
We irrigated cotton. I ran all the tractors. I ran a Massey Harris, Farmall, F-12, RC Case, milk cows. We had hogs. We had cotton, and we had alfalfa. And in the alfalfa, in those old days, we had more Johnson grass than we had alfalfa, but we still mowed hay. I ran the baler. We had an International Harvester baler, and I ran the baler. And at that time, we walked alongside the baler and poked the wires through a three-wire baler. And I developed a seat on each side that I could sit in and push the wires and have to walk. So we baled hay not only on our ranch, but on Mr. Benson's ranch or anybody else. We could earn extra money, my brother-in-law. We towed the baler with a 1924 Dodge truck.
But at this time, and you mentioned, you know, right after Pearl Harbor, everything was Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor. And I'm sure you knew that other guys your age were starting to go in the service. Was there a thought in your mind that at some point you were going to be involved in this war?
No, I tried to get in at that time, but I didn't go to school here, so I didn't know anybody my age in around here. And the two boys that I knew, Mr. Benson's son, Chuck Benson, and a bean boy, we were the two boys, and we were friends, the three of us. They were all involved in farming. They had an enlistment deal, and I went in there, and I was told, "You're deferred for as a strategic person in farming, and they need farmers more than they need soldiers." So we stayed there.
And did you say you tried to get into the Army Air Corps at one point?
At one time, yeah.
Were you thinking you wanted to be a pilot, or?
No, as a mechanic. I loved mechanic work. I did all the mechanic work on the farm. I had an old Fordson tractor that I rebuilt. I used the Fordson tractor in order to scrape with the Fordson tractor. We doubled the wheels, the big steel wheels on the back. Instead of one set of wheels, we had doubles on each side, and we'd tear the ground up with that tractor. So it was just a continuous farming operation.
Well, it sounds like it, and we certainly understand why that was strategically important. You need to be able to feed all these soldiers overseas, not to mention the people in America. But so when you tried to get into the service, what was your motivation for trying to enlist?
I just liked being a mechanic, and I wasn't doing enough mechanical work on the farm, and my brother-in-law and I didn't get along real great. We did get along partially, but he didn't do anything at all. He was not a worker. And in those days, we would take bicycle tires, which were inflatable at that time, and cut them in thirds. And that would be a half moon for each third of the tire. And we use those for siphons in irrigating. Then if you could had the money, you would buy boiler tubing, 1¼-inch boiler tubing, and use that. But the problem with boiler tubing was so heavy, you could only carry about 5 at a time. We used rubber tires more than anything.
You mean they don't do that anymore around here?
I don't think anybody could set a siphon anymore down there.
So you're working here on the farm. You've tried to get into the service.
I was told that You can't, you're classified. That kind of ended me right there. I went to Fresno State College in 1942, and by the draft board, I was told if I took three agricultural classes, I would be accepted going to school learning agriculture. So I went to Fresno State College. At that time, I was on McKinley, and I went to, and I took dairy products, ag survey, and viticulture. The dairy products class, where there were six of us, and I furnished the milk. The teacher was studying to be have his master's degree, and he gave me the dairy book, and he said, read chapter one, and then you teach chapter one, and I'll be in the office. So chapter two, chapter three would come up, and I would teach each chapter on how to do the Babcock test and all the other things. And I still have some of the glasses out there in the shop from testing.
And you were supposed to be a student.
I was a student.
But you end up teaching the class.
I got teaching the class, and I got an A in that. And in viticulture, John Benson had vineyard, and he taught me how to prune. And then when I had the class pruning, we had the same six kids in viticulture and maybe a couple more, but they didn't know how to prune. So I taught them how to prune, and the instructor, O.M. Brower, he didn't know anything at all about viticulture. So I got an A in viticulture. And then the ag survey was, we were given by Sisk, who was the congressman at that time, a complete set of agriculture books. There were probably 12 of them. And by owning those books, that made me in charge of ag survey. And I got an A in that. So I graduated with three A's. And I was called into the office and told that I had to take English and PE and history. And I said, well, the draft board will only let me take the three classes. They said, this is a teaching college. You cannot continue here unless you take these other classes. They called the draft board, and the draft board said no. So they released me from school. So I wound up with three classes that I have on my record. At Fresno State in 1942.
Never went back.
No, and I 1940 worked on the farm, and then 1944 I was in the service. I couldn't go back. I couldn't get released from the draft board anyway.
You mentioned something there that you had learned how to prune, and then you're a student in this class. You end up teaching everybody else in the class how to prune the vines. Is there a simple overview of that, that for a layman like me or the people listening, that you would say what the key to correctly pruning a grapevine would be?
Well, depending on the vines, we had Thompson seedless in there at Fresno State, and you leave your canes 3 or 4 feet long. You prune from 4 to 6 canes per vine. You tie them on the wire at that point in time. We had three wires, top wire, middle wire, bottom wire. Then they changed over to putting three wires horizontal instead of vertical. And then I showed them how to wrap the canes around the wire. And then we took care of the vines accordingly.
How old are the vines you have out here?
1947, they were planted by Kenny Seibert. I don't like to say it, but we're kind of exotic farmers here. We farm entirely different from a nutrient value. We go in with potassium and calcium 4 to 5 times in spray during the growing season. The potassium puts sugar into the fruit. The calcium hardens the skins on the fruit. So we wind up with a larger berry than if you're farming plain Zante currants. We are probably one of the last hand-picked Zante currants. Everybody has gone to machine harvest. And the difference between machine harvest is they're picked later, they're harvested later, and they don't have the quality or the meat, the body in the raisins, the berry that we have. We have a total of 10,314 vines here. We farm them, and we're on top of the line of producing and quality.
But before Doug Johnson could grow all those raisins, he had to get home from World War II. We'll hear more about his unique contributions to the war effort, what put him in the hospital in the Philippines, and the photo he had in his locker overseas that means even more to him today than it did then. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.